Hello, and welcome to the Project Elected podcast. Project Elect is a nonpartisan nonprofit whose goal is pretty simple. We want to get more Latter-day Saint women involved in public service. On this podcast, we interview amazing Latter-day Saint women who are involved in public service. Hi, my name is Audrey Perry Martin. I'm the founder of Project Elect and the host of this podcast.
I am so excited today to talk to Emily Bell McCormick. She's the founder and president of The Policy Project, which is this really innovative public policy nonprofit that's moving the needle for good in Utah. I'm excited to hear more about what they're doing, her new initiative, and what got her started in public policy and why she thinks it's important. Emily, so happy to have you here and great to reconnect. Apparently, we went to college together.
That's what happens when 20 years go by, Audrey.
I know, right? I'm so excited to hear your story. And I think we have similar thoughts about why it's important to be in politics and public policy. So tell me your story. How did you get interested in public policy? Has it always been a thing? Is it more recent?
Because we had the same college experience. I'm going to go back to that time. And I did not really know what my career options were. I feel like I went to college and was like, I'm here because that was, I had the great fortune of being born in a family where that was the natural next step, but not because I knew exactly what I was going to do in life. And I remember being a little drawn to politics. I remember thinking, oh, I love political science. That's really cool. But I actively had the thought, but there are no jobs in political science. I had never seen anything modeled, right? I was like, if I do political science, to me, it was like doing the humanities. Like, you can't get a job in this. What do you actually do with it? I was interested in it and naturally liked it, but I went for a very practical major. I did broadcast journalism right along with you. Yeah. And it was such a great thing. I think you learn how to write, you learn how to assimilate information, all of those things. So that was lovely. And then I worked in marketing and public affairs, public relations for a few years and went back to school and got a master's in communication. So still stayed in that zone. I worked like as a, I actually founded an apparel company called Shabby Apple back in the day. We did dresses. It was this new idea, which is hilarious now because we all buy all of our clothes online. But at the time, nobody was really buying their clothes online. We did dresses that were conservative and like work ready, really cute. I did that for about 5 years. And then spent a couple years doing communication consulting. During that whole process, I was also raising a family. I was having kids. That portion of my life was ever present at that time. And I had started, I'd always had a very big interest actually in poverty. And especially when it came to American poverty, because I found it unbelievable that I could grow up where I grew up and have a certain experience, and that someone that went to my same elementary, junior high school, whatever, was growing up 2 or 3 miles from me and having a completely different life experience. So I think that always was unsettling for me. I didn't think you could do anything about it. I just was unsettled by it. And I was also a little unsettled by women's position in the world. I think very early on, I'd picked up on some cues that maybe my life trajectory should be different from my brother's. And that wasn't even parental based. I think it was just like the whole society I grew up in gave me that message. And so somewhere in between like this concern about poverty and a concern about women, I started reading a lot of books. And I got to a point where I had digested so much information that told me the world did not have to be this way, that it was based on a series of laws and ideas and basically market forces that were much bigger than me, but that someone had actually set up, and that we were all living our lives inside of a model that someone else created. And it took me a minute to be able to pinpoint, how do you actually impact this? I knew I needed to do something about it because I got very anxious about it and was really struggling to sleep at night. Like just, I was really amped up about this idea of disparity. At the time, my parents were serving a religious mission in South Africa. I'd read a lot about apartheid, again, on those same themes where 90% of a population owned only 10% of the wealth, and 10% of a population owned 90% of the wealth. And this was all done on racial lines. That was the only thing, you know, there wasn't any like, oh, well, you're tall, you're short. No, it was just race-based. Like that's how they decided to draw that line. And when I went to visit my parents who were living there, apartheid ended only 25, 30 years ago, somewhere in that time frame. So it was relatively recent that people could pursue an education, people could pursue the jobs they wanted, but there were still so many like impacts that you could see or outcomes from such a destructive system. I basically spent the whole trip trying to figure out what is the system? Why is the world like this? And we went to this apartheid museum. It's a beautiful museum, tons of artifacts, lots of pictures from throughout apartheid. And I'm walking through, weaving through this museum, and I get to this point where there's this huge brick wall. And there's something on the brick wall. I can't tell what it is. I get closer, and there are these small, like little small plaques. Each brick had a plaque on it. And on each plaque, there was an act or a policy or a law. And individually, no big deal, right? One of them was like, hey, if you have brown skin, you've got to carry a passport. The next one would be like, hey, if you have brown skin, you got to be in at 10. Actually, let's make that 8 p.m. Okay. Hey, if you have brown skin, can't get past a high school degree. Oh, actually, we're going to move that up to third grade. So can't be educated past third grade. Can't pursue these professions. And so I could see like all of this like boggling in my mind over like, how do you actually impact the system in which we all live? Became totally clear to me in that moment. Like for me, the solution, the way that we could build a society that was beautiful was by taking the exact model that they took to build something that was so destructive and ugly and doing the same thing by enacting one little policy at a time that made the system better, that made it more livable, that made it more equitable, that made it more loving. That was the birth of the organization that you mentioned that I founded called the Policy Project. And our whole goal is really around using policy to find solutions to some of life's biggest problems, especially in regards to women, children, and people living in poverty.
It's incredible. And I love how visual the wall you're describing is. I mean, just I've worked in policy for a long time and just, you know, it is, it's little by little. It's not all just one big bill, one big act that was passed. It's hundreds and thousands of different policies that either take you in a good direction or a bad direction. And that's amazing how that it became clear to you that you could actually do something like chip away at the bad policies and build good ones. I love that story.
Yeah. And I think Audrey, like just what you were saying, I have to add on to that whole idea of like, it's the tiny things, it's the minutiae you can't see, right? Because everyone's paying attention if there's a massive crazy bill that might pass, but groundwork has always been laid for that bill to even have a place there. So I know this is obviously a passion you and I really share, just the impact that can have. And sometimes we have to pay attention to the small things too.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because they are important and they build on each other completely. So tell me a little bit. I know you guys at Policy Project, you've done a couple initiatives and you've got a new one going. Tell me about what you've done in the past and what you're working on now.
We started with menstrual policy. Again, like right along the theme of women, I will say it wasn't easy work, but it was low-hanging fruit in that there was nothing on the books around menstruation. And when I say nothing, there was not a single law in the United States of America around menstruation, right? I started in about 2018 and a couple things had happened before that, but really 2015, nothing in America existed around menstruation. So I just want to push pause. And I know I don't have to tell your listeners this, but I still am going to, but the irony of that, you think of the policies we have in place for everything. I love to talk about COVID. Think how quickly we were masking, we were sanitizing, we were six-footing each other. We're doing all this stuff. That impacted in the beginning about 20% of the population after about a year, 20% of the population. Menstruation has impacted 50% of the population since not 3 years ago, the beginning of time. And so here's this massive public health issue that has not even been addressed whatsoever. The impact of it is so profound and so sudden that if a woman starts menstruating, you know, if I start menstruating right now, I need to push pause, take a break, go take care of it. And I can come back and function. But without the proper supplies, you're not actually able to function. You're not able to stand in the grocery store line, sit in the boardroom, punch the clock, whatever you're doing that day. Like you don't get to do it. You don't get to help in the classroom that day because you have to care for menstruation. So the fact that nothing had been done was just like, it was like a heavenly irony for me because it was such the obvious issue to take on as the first thing. Like menstruation, just it's a no-brainer. So needless to say, started with that as she worked on the tampon tax. I won't go into that. It's a very long story, but tampon tax is basically this idea idea that like, oh, a lot of our products that are medically necessary are not taxed. In fact, none of our products that have been deemed medically necessary are taxed, but period products were still taxed. Meanwhile, suntan lotion, not taxed. Band-Aids, not taxed. Rogaine, not taxed. Viagra, not taxed. These things are, some of us would consider hair growth optional, menstruation not. It was like, we just need to equalize this. Worked on the tampon tax. We were able to get rid of the tampon tax in Utah. Unfortunately, it was attached to a larger tax reform bill, and that got turned over like a month later. So all period products were tax-free for a month in Utah. And at that point, I'd been working on it for a couple of years. I was feeling so discouraged. And so I ended up going back to the drawing board, meeting with some of the legislators I'd been working with and saying, listen, if you're not going to give me the tampon tax, then what about putting period products in schools? Like, the impact is so much greater because you've got half of the students who are going to need them, 90% by the age of 13, but 15% by the age of 8, which is crazy. And this will just change their lived experience. You're spending all this money putting all these things into the classroom to make people pay attention and make them stay in school to try to help them get good grades. Meanwhile, this is impacting all the students. I still didn't think they would take it. I thought the legislators would be like, no, we're not doing that. The price tag's too high. That's like too weird of an idea. Like, we can't do it. And actually, I was thrilled. The Speaker of the House at the time, Brad Wilson, was like, yeah, I think we could do that. I think that's a good idea. I think we should do it. And so the second that door opened, I was like, and go, we are going to do this. So I started building a team. Before that, I'd really been working with other organizations and doing a lot of it on my own. And I just knew I can't do this one on my own. We've got to blow this up big because we need the general population to understand the importance of this. If we're shoving this down their throat, as basic as it seems now, at the time it was like, people are not going to be used to this idea. This is a new idea. They're going to be like, government shouldn't pay for this. Family should provide it. This is inappropriate. We shouldn't be talking about private parts. Da, 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 da. Needless to say, started building a team, got a couple incredible women to join in, and we were able to pass legislation that all girls and all gender bathrooms in the state of Utah in grades kindergarten through 12th grade would provide free period products. It was a huge win. It sounds basic now, but it was a big fat win. And Utah was actually the first state to do it at that level. Now, some other states like California said like schools should provide these, but it was like grade 7 through 12, right? We were the most comprehensive solution and the only one to do K through 12. So pretty awesome for the state of Utah. Pretty thrilled about that. We built from there, never intending to just do menstrual policy. That is definitely something we will always have a focus on. But we built from there. The next year, we worked on something we called the Teen Center Project, which was putting teen resource centers into high schools throughout the state. As it turns out, in the state of Utah, 1 in 50 kids is experiencing homelessness. And we have lower rates of poverty in the state of Utah. So that is so bizarre. That blew my mind. You take two classrooms of 25 and one of those kids is experiencing homelessness. That's not acceptable. We went around the state to learn a little bit more about this. And I just want to share the story because I think stories sometimes have the greatest impact. But we were in Richfield, Utah, and talking to a principal there. And she said that the bus driver had come in the other day. It was January. If anyone has ever been to a rural Utah in January, windy, freezing, a boy had come out of a stack of crates. So crates, pallets that they deliver food to Costco on. There were some stacked crates and the boy had come out a little cardboard door, come out of there. In Beaver, there was a girl who'd been eating cat food because her family did not have food. In St. George, there was a group of kids sleeping on the stage and the principal came in, saw it, didn't ever tell anyone, turned around and walked out because he knew they had nowhere to go. So I think like it was all over. It would be in any state because, again, like I said, Utah has actually lower poverty rates. All over our state, there was so much poverty, so much need. These kids did not have a safe place to go. And so creating basically a space, just like you think, creating what we're calling a teen center in high schools. It has showers. It has laundry facilities. It provides grab-and-go food, like string cheese. We heard from a student in Northern Utah, like, it's so nice they give me mac and cheese and ramen, but I can't cook that in my car, and I live in my car. That doesn't work. We've got to be able to meet these kids where they're at. It's never the kids' fault. It's never the kids' fault. We were able to get funding the next legislative session for 75 of Utah's 200 high schools to get teen centers, these full resource centers in the school, which is really cool. And now We are working on what we're calling the Safe Child Project. This one is super brutal to talk about, but it is all about child sexual abuse and the prevention of child sexual abuse. And we have a legislative component to that, but about 1 in 5 kids in the state of Utah is being sexually abused. That does not include anything with digital media. So that does not include, we used to call it child pornography. It's now called child sexual abuse materials, but that doesn't include anything with that. So that number is probably higher than that. And it really does not know any like socioeconomic boundaries, nothing. So we're working on a bill that would basically put child sexual abuse prevention curriculum into kindergarten through sixth grade classrooms, so the kids can develop a source of or a list of resources, because 90% of the time it's someone that they know that is causing the abuse. So to say, tell your parents, tell your brother, tell your sister, tell your aunt, tell your uncle, like that ends up not being safe usually for them. So anyway, we're working on that. It's a tough topic, but there is a lot of hope in it. I think that we are going to really change the conversation around child sexual abuse.
I think you guys are so brave to be taking on these topics that are hard to talk about. They're not the easiest topics you want to talk about at dinner or over Thanksgiving or whatever, but they're so important. And the impact that and the change that you can make is ginormous for these kids. It's incredible. And you're so inspired in what you're doing. It's just amazing.
Thank you. It is a ton of work, but you'd only make this kind of sacrifice for this kind of work. It does feel like, okay, someone's got to do it. And there isn't a long line right now. I think this is something we need to do.
Yeah. There's not a lot of people who are brave enough to speak openly about these issues and make it something that people get behind to actually do something about instead of just trying to forget about it, because that's easier. So why do you think it's important for women to speak up on issues, women in particular?
I have the great luxury of knowing the exact answer to that question because of my time spent in women's issues and specifically menstruation. There is not a chance on earth that our nation would be founded in 1776 and that it would be the year 2023 and we wouldn't have period products still in 30, 40 states, like within the schools there, that it wouldn't be totally normalized by now if women would have been at the table in 1776. There's not even we wouldn't have even made it to 1800 without that being taken care of, because it's such an obvious need. So that one is very basic. It's super simple. But when you think about the impact of it, I had to make an argument more than once that access to period products was a public health issue, an education issue, a workforce issue, and a privacy issue. And let me tell you, when I introduced that in the framework of those four topics, most legislators met me with, "That's not true. Why do you say that?" And it was like, it's an education issue because 50% of our students experience this and they have to leave immediately. It's a public health issue because it's 50% of the population. And just the definition of public, anything with public health is a majority, like a not even a majority. It's just a large number of humans who are dealing with one issue. So public health, it's a workforce issue because for the people at the lowest income brackets, they are losing their jobs. If you're working at 7-Eleven and you don't have period products, you're not going to work. And it's a privacy issue because we would never take all of the toilet paper out of the bathrooms and move to a donation model. Say, hey, anybody in the neighborhood who wants to donate, just drop off some toilet paper here. And so when our kids need to go, all they have to do is raise their hand, say, I need to use the bathroom, go to the office, stand in line, wait while someone they have a crush on is right behind them, say, can I get some toilet paper? And then they ask you, there was none donated today, or maybe there was, what kind do you want? And then walk back to the bathroom. If you haven't had an accident by then, you can clean up and go back to class. If you've had an accident, you got to go home. We would never do that. It's ludicrous. That's such a huge invasion of privacy. We wouldn't do it. And yet we've done that for centuries, literally. And so not having women at the table has created a system in which we have natural disadvantages. And I'm not saying that many women experience happiness. Many women have wonderful lives. Many women are very content, and that is wonderful. I want all women to be that way. But the reality is, when it comes to the law, we are not represented in historic laws in the United States. They were intended for men. And without us there, things are being overlooked. And so we have to have a seat at the table. We have to have a voice. And the beautiful thing about this, because I don't know if you get this, Audrey, but sometimes I'll get feedback like, men are really being hurt right now because there's such a focus on women. And I will hear that on occasion. the beautiful thing is that the science is showing that when women do well, men do better. That when men do well, women do better. When women do well, men do better. Like, we actually do better when we all do better. I don't think we have an idea of how beautiful society can be. We don't know because we've never had laws that really protect women and help women to a degree that we need it. And I think we'll be thrilled with the outcomes of those. Like, what does life look like for women? What does life look like for men? What does it look like for our kids? Let me tell you, it's better than what we're seeing now. And life is good now.
And it's so true. There are blind spots that men have that aren't necessarily their fault. They just have a different experience than women. Like, menstruation is such a perfect example of that, right? It's like, you can't come up with a better example than they just don't understand. They just don't know. It's not something they experience. And so having women at the table would automatically solve that problem.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the same reverse. If it had been women since 1776, we would have some massive holes in legislation, because I'd be like, nobody wants to play a video game. Why would we do that? Legislation and free market, I should say. Nobody wants to watch football 7 days a week. No one will ever do that. I'd be wrong. And billions and trillions of dollars would prove that I was wrong. I'm very comfortable with, we need both, you know, we need everyone at the table.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So tell me about what your life looks like as somebody who speaks out and tries to make change. What's your day-to-day? What are you doing? What kind of things are you, you know, involved in?
That is a great question. Like, I just want to know. Yeah, it is. Life is crazy. It is very busy. I would say, because anything political or government-based is by nature public, like, everyone gets to have an opinion. So although I am not an elected official, the work we do is always with elected officials. It's always with philanthropists. It's with people who have extremely public jobs and are held accountable at that standard. We are a nonprofit, 501c3, and that has a high accountability. That is a public entity where people get to give feedback. It's very busy. I think, like, just a day in the life is a whole lot of meetings with a lot of different stakeholders. You're with the legislature, then you're trying to raise money, then you're trying to work with a group that thinks that you're doing it the wrong way. Then you're trying to grow public awareness around an issue that's really awkward to talk about, or where there's a lot of hesitancy. Some people think it's inappropriate. And I think we're protecting the wrong people if we don't talk about it, you know. So it's always working through that. I will say that one of the things that I love and think is neat is that you can bring your whole self to the table in this work. And I'm sure you experience the same, Audrey, where it's like, I didn't go into broadcast journalism. I did it in school, did never pursue that outside of school. And yet I use those skills all the time. I am a mother. I have 5 children. I don't do that full time, but I use all of the skills that I learn from motherhood in my work. And I use the skills I learned in my work, in my motherhood. It's very busy. It's very chaotic. It's pretty public, but I do love the work so much because it feels like it's making a difference. And that is a gift. And I know it's a gift. I know it's a privilege to work on it. I am so grateful that I get to, and just to be able to combine all my learnings into one kind of space is very magical.
I love how you call it a gift, because it truly is a gift to be able to feel like you are making an impact, even on just one person's life. And if you're making an impact on many people's lives, like you guys are at the Policy Project, that can keep you going for a long time. It's really a fantastic feeling. You've accomplished a lot. You talk about how you work with elected officials. What have you learned through that process? What has been effective and helpful? I'm sure the list is way too long, but just a couple of things that maybe are helpful.
That's a wonderful question. I don't think I've ever been asked that before. If I could go back to myself in the year 2017, before I'd ever even talked to an elected official, I literally had to confirm that there were indeed 2 chambers. I was not even sure what was going on. So if I could go back then and tell myself something, I think I would say most elected officials want to do good. They are thinking about getting to that end result in very different ways. Some elected officials actually don't care about doing good. And that is something that is actually true. Most do. I would also tell myself that there are no prerequisites to becoming an elected official. you don't need to have a college degree. In fact, our last governor, he finished high school and he was governor for 8 years and a senator before that. You don't have to have a certain career path. You didn't have to have learned, like really been obsessed with your civics class. I wish I would have known that. Number one, it would have taken the edge off for me when dealing with other people. Like, this person is so incredibly human. They're just like me. No need to be intimidated. Absolutely need to respect, because all humans should be respected, but no need to be intimidated. But also to understand that, like, they don't have the corner market on knowledge. They don't know. Like, one of my surprises as when we worked on menstruation was, like, many men who were married, had kids, had daughters, did not understand that menstruation was spontaneous. They thought that you could hold it like you can hold number one and number two. There was a learning curve. I didn't know that wasn't common knowledge, but you don't know that if someone doesn't tell you that, right? Like, you don't know that. And so just giving them some grace, don't assume they know everything. They don't. And most of them are willing to learn, some not. But I think if you have some expertise in something, you should share it. You should be willing to talk about it. You should share it. They're not the experts in everything. They're just there to represent a population.
That's very good points right there. And I want to flip that and say, because there are no qualifications to run, and because as long as you're willing to learn and do good, that makes you qualified, right? That if you're willing to run for office, you don't need specific qualifications. You don't need a law degree. You don't even need a college degree. You just have to, hopefully, you want to do good and are willing to learn, right?
Totally. And I would say, especially, you are completely right. Like, I was in a conversation with a woman maybe a year ago, and she was like, expressing an interest in running for the legislature. I'm like, you have to. This woman is so, she's smart. She's kind. She's a wonderful woman. And she was like, yeah, but I don't have, I know, I think I need to go get my master's first. I was like, can you actually come with me to the Capitol for an afternoon? Let me introduce you to 10 elected officials who are lovely humans, but you're going to realize you absolutely have a place here. You got all types here. You have our current Speaker of the House, Mike Schultz, who was just elected. He doesn't have a college degree. He's done wonderfully in his business. He's a wonderful, very smart man. He's a rancher. He's very smart. But there is no traditional path. We just, as women, we got to let go of that thought. We have to burn it up and throw it in the garbage and just know, if you have an interest, you're qualified. If you're willing to take a year of your life and run, you're qualified. You do it.
100%. And I feel like I'm beating that drum all the time, because those of us who have worked with elected officials a lot instinctively know that all these women would be fantastic at it. You don't need a master's degree. It's good to be involved in your community and want to do good and care and be willing to run. And that's it. You would be great if you had those things, right?
Amen. I am there with you. I will echo every word you just said.
So, what's your favorite way to reach out to other women about issues that are important to you? How do you get this message out? Not just to the elected officials, but to, you were talking about changing the public mindset and moving the needle that way. How do you do that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I grew up, I'm too old to feel supernatural about social media, but I do think it's an insane tool, and I've tried to use it more. It doesn't come naturally to me. I feel a little awkward. I grew up in an era of there should always be a third party that is like validating your viewpoint. So that is a little unnatural for me, but I think that it should never be underestimated, the power of social media. Like, it's free. It's at your fingertips. People use it as entertainment and they get their news from it now. Like, use that for sure. I also love to reach women through just gathering. I think for me, I really love interpersonal stuff. I am a one-on-one person. I like that feeling. And so anytime I can be physically present with someone, I love it. So if there are occasions when I can do that, I try to say yes. I would say, especially for women that might be looking to get into the public life, whether that's on the being an elected official or doing a nonprofit or whatever it is, working for a philanthropy, I would just say, be willing to say yes. Once you start saying yes, you get more opportunities without a question. And so I think that's a big key for there.
That's good advice. How has your family liked being a part of this? How have you gotten your family involved? What have they thought about this? I know you said you had 5 kids. So just wondering, are they all on board? Do they want to ignore it? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm 45 and I grew up really not seeing women in the workforce, just the neighborhood I grew up in and stuff. I didn't see that a lot. And so I feel like I started my motherhood with a lot of kind of, I still have some of the shame that this younger generation doesn't, the guilt feelings that they maybe don't experience, or hopefully don't experience, they shouldn't experience. And so I felt guilty about like always having such a big desire to work. And I, about probably, gosh, maybe between 5 and 10 years ago, I just dug in my heels and was like, this is literally who I am. Like, I was created this way between God and nature. Like, here I am. And so what am I going to do? I can involve my family in the work to whatever degree I can. And so do I cook dinner? No, I don't. Do I do laundry? No, I don't. But do I take my kids up to the Capitol when we have a rally? Yes, I do. Do I make my kids come with me to any possible dinner or awards or anything like that that I can? Yes, I do. I had to start giving myself a lot more grace on motherhood, looking a lot of different ways. And so once I was able to do that, I could see, you know what? Because my kids do complain. They're like, Mom, oh my gosh, you never make dinner. Why do we have to eat like ramen again? Or blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, I know you have to, but have your friends gone and yeah, have they written a letter to their legislator yet this session? And they're
this
like,
session.
Pretty sure they'd rather have, I'm pretty sure they'd rather have mashed potatoes and gravy, but they get to write a letter. The other thing that I love about this for women is that the more we plug our families into the work, the more normalized it becomes. So now going up to the Capitol, the first time I took my kids up to the Capitol, I was embarrassed. Like they were being a little loud and it was like, I was, oh, I don't know. And I don't belong here. You definitely don't belong here. And now it's like so normalized. I can't even imagine if somebody were like, your kid is loud. I'd be like, house of the people, house of the people, never person. So I think it's just, I think like as much as we can incorporate them and allow them to see the work we do, it's going to help everyone.
No, I love that. And I love what you say about normalizing it because it does help it. And it also, it's great for your kids. My kids are the same way. They, at the moment, they want the mashed potatoes and gravy, but I'm like, but you got to do this and you got to do this. And they may not appreciate it right now, but I hope that they will appreciate it in the future. Right. And totally. Help them become somebody who isn't, I was in the same boat as you. I didn't really know the outside world very well. I was in a bubble growing up and I didn't know people needed help in different ways. And so I want my kids to know that. I want them to know, I want them to see, you know, the different public policy issues and that they can make a difference and really grow up knowing that. So that's fantastic. Sure. I love it. So Project Elect is, we are focused on Latter-day Saint women. And so I wanted to ask you, have you felt inspired in your journey? How is your relationship and have you prayed about it? Like, how has that worked into what you're doing?
Yeah, I would say that has been a huge part of what I'm doing. I think especially the origin story that I told at the beginning, the struggle was real. And I can like joke about it now. I'm like, oh, I wasn't sleeping. I was up from 3 until 5 every morning, like pacing the house. Wait a second. How can that, oh my gosh, that kid's going to get raped tonight or whatever. And how can we handle that? And they're going to go to prison for something that they didn't do. And all of the things that were like, it actually became like, it was a literal cross to bear. And it wasn't mine. I gave it to myself. I don't think for some reason I was like, I could not escape it though. Like nothing in my life said that I had to take it on, except that everything in my body told me I had to, right? And my spirit. And in my life, the only peace I find that is lasting is in Christ. And so for me, I'm going to die sometime between today and 40 years from now, right? Like I will die and the world will not be perfect yet. And so the assurance that I found is through Christ. Thank the heavens. I couldn't even handle like living a single day without knowing that there would be a great equalizer. That said, I will say that I felt extremely blessed and lucky and privileged to have found the work that I found. And I believe it's God's work. I don't ever say that publicly because I think sometimes we get certain sides that say this is God's work and they get really holier. It can get like holier than thou or something, but I'm just saying for me, this is God in me. Like this is what I can do with my life to show that I respect and love a heavenly mother and heavenly father and a Christ. Like that's what I'm going to do with it because I believe I was given every advantage in the world. And so I owe it to the world And anyway, it's very tied to that. That probably was totally nonsensical because that is another question I'm never asked, but that was absolutely like prayer was a huge and is a huge part of this, but it absolutely was in the founding of this and in the movement forward. Just that access to the divine is extremely important to me.
It sounds like you were really called to do it. Like you just felt that you had to do it and God was telling you it was your mission. So I love that you listened and are just going forward with it and doing such amazing things for disadvantaged and people who really need help and don't often have advocacy as great as yours. So that's really inspiring to me. I am so inspired and motivated by you. And so I appreciate all you guys are doing. The last question I wanted to ask you is, do you have a invitation for our listeners to maybe get involved in public policy or a small step they can take towards making a difference?
We have a lot of opportunities, like even just through our organization. So if you are getting into this, if this is new to you, there are a lot of organizations that do beautiful, wonderful things like Project Elect. Getting involved in an organization you love. With our organization, we do have a community champion. We call them a community champions, where it can be very minimal. And then it can amp up to something big if you love the work, but it basically gives you exposure to the work. It gives you opportunities to volunteer, helps you like lead out in your little community on whatever project we're working on at that moment. And really, I would say the cool thing about attaching to an organization is that you all of a sudden have a platform. When I was just me, before I like literally stuck the words, the policy project on the work I was doing, it was just lost in the mix. And so I think don't overlook the importance of like connecting with like-minded people. And you don't have to start your own. You don't have to do this on your own. There are so many neat organizations out there, but I would definitely encourage and welcome and love anyone to join us through the Community Champion Program or through the volunteer program, or we also hire people. There are a lot of different ways to get involved in the work we're doing, and we need everyone there. And I just have to say, Audrey, it has been so fun to connect with you. I love Project Elect. I have known a couple of people who've been involved with us over the years, and I am just so grateful for the work that you guys do and for bringing women to the table. Like, such important work, also God's work.
Thank you, Emily. It has seriously been such a pleasure talking to you. And I appreciate you taking the time from your busy schedule. And I hope you have a great legislative session coming up and keep in touch.
Thank you all for listening to Project Elected podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to projectelectwomen.org. We're also on Instagram and Facebook as Project Elect Women. We'd love for you to subscribe, rate us, or give us a review on iTunes. So until next time, thank you.